Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 60, which I will entitle The Future Glory of Israel. That would be the new Israel, the church. Let me give you some introduction from Albert Barnes. In this chapter, there is commenced a most glowing and beautiful description of the golden age under the Messiah. The description is continued to the close of Isaiah 62, verses 1 through 12. It is adorned with the highest ornaments of poetry. The future glory of the church is displayed under the most splendid colors and with every variety of imagery. It is designed to set forth the glory of that time when the Gentiles shall be gathered into the church and when the whole world shall become tributary to the Messiah and be illuminated with the light of Christian truth. The main design of the chapter is to foretell the conversion of the pagan world and the happy and peaceful times which shall exist when that has occurred. Now, I think as we go through this, you will see that it obviously refers to the coming of the church under the Messiah, as Barnes says, but there are also enough local references to make me think Isaiah was also referring to the return from captivity in Babylon on the part of the Old Testament Jews. So we begin now in Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 3. Isaiah begins, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the peoples. But the Lord rises upon you, and his glory appears over you. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn." Well, the first question we have here, who is being referred to? Your light, your dawn, who's the your? Well, it's Zion. And of course, Zion is the symbol, Mount Zion is the symbol of the New Testament church. The subject of address is not revealed till verse 14, as the pulpit commentary points out. So I will read Isaiah 60, verse 14. "The sons of those who afflicted you will come bowing to you, and all those who despised you will bow themselves at the soles of your feet, and they will call you the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel." So this is talking about Zion. Now, whether it's Old Testament or New Testament Zion, or both, can always be a question. If you say it only refers to the Old Testament Zion, the problem is that the Old Testament nation of Israel never reached such pinnacles of glory that are described in this chapter. Well, this light, your light, the light of Zion, may be referred to the very flourishing condition of the Church of Jesus Christ. That's the way Barnes, Benson, Ellicott, and Poole take it. That would be the period of the gospel dispensation, the church age. As Adam Clark says, when both Jews and Gentiles shall become one fold under one shepherd. Well, that's option number one, the church at Jesus' first coming. Option number two is the church at the Lord's second advent. This is Jameson Fawcett and Brown's suggestion. He says that Isaiah is writing here an ode of congratulation to Zion concerning her true position as the mother church, from which the gospel is to be diffused to the whole Gentile world. Now, Jameson Fawcett and Brown doesn't say that process begins at the second advent of the Lord. He says it began at the first advent and continues all the way to the second advent. Here's a quotation from those commentators. Quote, "The first promulgation of the gospel among the Gentiles, beginning at Jerusalem, is an earnest of this light and glory and brightness that's mentioned here in the first three chapters. Jameson Fawcett and Brown say the language in chapter 60 is too glorious to apply to anything that as yet has happened." Well, I don't know about that. It just depends on how you take the imagery. You could say that what happens in the New Testament church is pretty glorious, us getting saved. So that's a matter of opinion. Now in verse 1, Isaiah says that the glory of the Lord rises upon you, upon Zion. That could refer to the Shekinah glory of God that did rise upon the Old Testament Zion, the Old Testament Israel. The Shekinah glory rested above the ark, if you will recall. But that glory could also mean the glory of the Lord in person, which would, of course, refer to the advent of the Lord at the end of time. This is an old theological speculation. Where are the prophets prophesying to? Are they prophesying to the first coming, the millennial reign between the first and second advents, or are they prophesying to the millennial reign after the second coming of Christ? I prefer the former solution, but I can't prove it from here. You have to go into some complicated theology if you want to get into premill versus non-premill interpretations of eschatology. So we will just leave it here as open, the glory of the Lord rises upon Zion. I'm going to take it as the New Testament church. See, darkness covers the earth and thick darkness is over the peoples. That would refer to the spiritual condition of the Gentiles during the time of the New Testament church. However, the Lord rises upon you and his glory appears over you. The glory of the Lord appears over the New Testament church, even as the Shekinah glory of God appeared over the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. Nations will come to your light. Nations, of course, are Gentiles. They're going to come to your light, the light of the gospel. Jesus is the light of the world, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Now, since Isaiah says that nations will come, and we know that nations have come to the church in the time of the New Testament church from the first century onward, even in the book of Acts, and we know that Gentile kings have embraced the gospel of Christ, such as in Armenia. Many nations of the earth are full of the doctrine of Christ. So, that's why I think it refers to the first century church and beyond, the inter-advent period between the first and second coming of Christ, because nations are coming to Jesus in that period, and kings. We go now to Isaiah 60, verses 4 through 7. Isaiah continues. Actually, this is God speaking through Isaiah, because in verse 7, Yahweh says, I will adorn my glorious temple. That's not talking about Isaiah. That's talking about Yahweh. So Yahweh says, starting in verse 4, lift up your eyes and look about you, all assemble and come to you. Your sons come from afar, and your daughters are carried on the arm. Then you will look and be radiant. Your heart will throb and swell with joy. The wealth on the seas will be brought to you. To you the riches of the nations will come. Herds of camels will cover your land, young camels of Midian and Ephah, and all from Sheba will come, bearing gold and incense and proclaiming the praise of the Lord. All Kedar's flocks will be gathered to you. The rams of Nebaioth will serve you. They will be accepted as offerings on my altar, and I will adorn my glorious temple. Now in verse 4, Isaiah says, or Yahweh says, that all assemble and come to you, come to Zion. Now, of course, we naturally assume that's referring to the Gentiles, but we need to remember there's converted Jews as well that come to the New Testament Zion. There weren't a lot of them, but there were some. After all of the early 12 disciples were all Jewish. You had the mother church at Jerusalem, so all would include Gentiles as well as Jews. They will come from afar. That sounds like Gentiles. Your daughters are carried on their arm. You picture pilgrims coming in, carrying their little kids, carrying their little girls in their arms. In verse 5, Zion will look and shine in their face. And in verse 5, Zion will look and be radiant, shining. Zion's heart will throb and swell with joy. And then, at the end of verse 5, we have financial metaphors. The wealth on the seas will be brought to you. The riches of the nations will come. Now, I really hope that the cash flow dollars of this world are not using this verse and others like it in this chapter to advocate for getting rich. Now, maybe they do. I haven't actually heard that yet. I wouldn't be surprised. I do not believe that this is what is being talked about here, the wealth on the seas being brought to Zion. It is a symbol of prosperity and success. No more poverty. No more shameful condition. A glorious situation. Now, some people have said that the wealth on the seas that are being brought to Zion is the wealth obtained by commerce, which will be put to the use of the church. Well, I don't know. Some have said that the wealth on the seas coming to Zion refers to the abundance of sailors who will get converted. I find that a little problematic. The translation here in the NIV is wealth on the seas, but two literal translations don't have wealth. The Young's literal translation has the multitude of the sea will be brought to you, and J.P. Green's literal translation has the abundance of the seas will be brought to you, or the abundance of the sea. Well, abundance of the sea, that could refer to wealth, but Young's literal says it's the multitude of the sea. It could be talking about lots of people coming from afar off into the kingdom. But at any rate, whatever that means, there are still plenty of financial metaphors to come. The riches of the nation will come at the end of verse 5. Now, some people, to get around the idea that it's wealth being brought in, point out that the Young's literal translation says the forces of the world are coming, meaning military forces. However, Green's literal has wealth of the nations. We're going to take it as riches of the nations are coming into the church, but as a symbolic thing. We go to verse 6. Herds of camels will cover your land, young camels of Midian and Ephah. Now, there is a local reference to the land of Israel, which makes me think this is referring to the restoration from Babylon as a type of the Gentiles and converted Jews coming into the church in the New Covenant era. Now, these young camels came from Midian and Ephah. Midian was a son of Abraham by Abraham's wife Keturah. We read in Genesis 25:4, the sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher, and Hanok, and Abida, and Eldah. All these were the sons of Keturah. Well, Ephah is the son that's mentioned here in Isaiah 60:5. So let's look at some geography here. The Midianites were Bedouins, lived in the desert. You remember the Midianites were these Bedouins that attacked Gideon, and Gideon ran them all across the Jordan River back to the east, ran them through the desert there. So we will assume that this is a prophecy of the conversion of the Arabians. The Arabians that dwell in Arabia Felix, Arabia Petraea, and Arabia Deserta. Now, these three deserts are famous all the way up until the early 1900s. They were called these names. The Romans divided up the desert areas around Israel into these three deserts and gave these deserts three different names. So it's good to know what's being referred to here. Arabia Felix is modern Yemen on the southwestern coast of Saudi Arabia. Arabia Petraea has its capital at Petra. Arabia Petraea, Petra, that makes sense. Petra is right to the east of Mount Seir, that range of mountains that's south of the Dead Sea. It's in present-day Jordan, but Arabia Petraea has more areas than that. If you'll go up the Mediterranean coast to Syria and go down to the southern edge of Syria and then go down through present-day Lebanon, Palestine, then keep going down through Israel and then go down to the Sinai Peninsula, which is between Egypt and Israel, and then you go east up to modern Jordan, which would mean you would go through Edom, south of the Dead Sea, cross Mount Seir into Jordan. That's Arabia Petraea. Now, Arabia Deserta is between the Jordan and the Euphrates River. And if you'll start at the Euphrates and go all the way south, all the way past the tips of the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Aqaba, and go all the way down to the Indian Ocean at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, that big area is called Arabia Deserta. So when we see that camels are coming from Midian, that's saying that the nations are coming into the church. And all from Sheba will come. Most scholars say Sheba is present-day Yemen, Arabia Felix, the southwestern corner of the Arabian Peninsula. Answers.com says that Sheba was an ancient country of southern Arabia comprising present-day Yemen. Its people colonized Ethiopia in the 10th century BC and were known for their wealth and commercial prosperity. That's Answers.com. Answers.com also says that Sheba enjoyed more rainfall, or I should say Arabia Felix, present-day Yemen, present-day Yemen, where Sheba is most probably located. Arabia Felix enjoys more rainfall and is much greener than the rest of the Arabian Peninsula. Thus, it gets its name as Happy Arabia. Felix is Happy Arabia Felix. Sheba, that area was famed for frankincense and gold, as we see in many references in the scripture. They traded in frankincense and gold. Prosperous place, but it's all going to be coming into the kingdom. People from Sheba will come bearing gold and incense, Isaiah says in verse 6, and they will proclaim the praise of the Lord. Precious gifts. That's what you do when you go visit a king in the ancient Near East. And they're going to be bringing gifts to the Lord. Verse 7, all Kedar's flocks will be gathered to you. Now, Kedar was the son of Ishmael, we read in Genesis 25:13. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names and the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, or Kedar. I'm not really sure how you pronounce that. Just as Jacob had 12 sons, the 12 sons of Israel, Ishmael had 12 sons, and the oldest of the 12 sons was Nebaioth. One of the other 12 sons was Kedar. Let me read you some scriptures where Kedar is mentioned. Isaiah 21:16-17. For the Lord said this to me, within 1 year, as a hired worker counts years, all the glory of Kedar will be gone. The remaining Kedarite archers will be few in number. Ezekiel 27:21. Arabia and all the princes of Kedar, They were your customers for lambs, rams, and goats. So Kedar, you can see rams, lambs, and goats. They were a nomadic people, sheep herders. Song of Songs 1 verse 5. Daughters of Jerusalem, says the Shunammite woman, I am dark like the tents of Kedar. The Bedouins, the Kedarites, they had tents made out of black sheep's wool. And so the Shunammite woman compares her skin to the color of the tents of Kedar. Now, according to historyfiles.co.uk, the people of Kedar were cousins of the Nabataeans. Now, the Nabataeans were desert people who ended up starting the kingdom of Nabatea, of which Petra was the capital, right there in Arabia Petraea. Well, we see that they're cousins of the Nabataeans, the Kedarites are, because they were both sons, their patriarchs were both sons of Ishmael. And so the people of Kedar inhabited the desert regions of eastern Syria and present-day Jordan, right there in the northern part of Arabia Deserta. Now, Nebaioth is considered to be the father of the Nabataeans, who ruled Arabia Petraea in the first several centuries A.D. If you go visit Petra, you will hear a lot about the Nabataeans. Petra, by the way, is a wonderful place to visit. I've been there, and if you ever find yourself over there in Jordan somehow, not exactly the easiest place in the world to get to, but it is a United Nations World Heritage Site, and it's quite a site, and it was created by the Nabataeans, and so that's why they're sort of famous, the Nabataeans. Well, the Nabataeans came from Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, at least according to Josephus, as Wikipedia reports. Josephus, the Jewish historian of the Roman era, described the descendants of Ishmael as Arabs, linking them with the historical Nabataeans of Hellenistic and Roman times. Hellenistic is post-Alexander the Great, 4th century B.C., all the way up through the Roman times. They croaked about roughly 476. It's debated, but in that area, that's when the Nabataeans were running Petra. I'll take Josephus at his word. At any rate, the point is that all over everywhere, especially the desert regions as well as the sea regions, riches would be brought into Zion. Wealth on the seas and herds of camels and incense and gold from the deserts. That more or less takes it all in. We go now to Isaiah 60, verses 8 through 9. Yahweh continues, Who are these that fly along like clouds, like doves to their nest? Surely the islands look to me. In the lead are the ships of Tarshish, bringing your sons from afar with their silver and gold to the honor of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. Who are these that fly along like clouds? Most probably refers to the numbers of converts that are flocking into the kingdom, like doves to their nest, like pure people going to find shelter in the church, just like a dove, a symbol of purity, goes to its nest. Surely the islands look to me, and of course the islands is the common metaphor that refers to nations a long, long way from Israel. So this is Gentiles coming into the new Mount Zion. Surely the islands look to me in the lead of the ships of Tarshish, most probably Tartessus in Spain. Some people say it's Tarsus where Paul was from. I don't think so. Some people say it's just the ships of the sea. No, we're going to say it's from Tartessus in Spain. I think that's in the southwestern corner of Spain. Famous for trading, famous for silver. In the lead of the ships of Tarshish, bringing your sons from afar with their silver and gold. To the honor of the Lord your God. Once more, a reference to the wealth coming into the kingdom. Again, I believe it's a metaphor for spiritual wealth. I keep thinking every time I read that, somebody, a Catholic, is going to say, see there, that's why the medieval church was so rich. To the honor of the Lord your God, to the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. I think it's just a symbol for the splendor of the church, not being so physical about it. Now, ships from Tarshish actually brought gold and silver into the nation of Israel during the times of Solomon, which is before Isaiah. They were famous for that. Now, I said that I believe this is symbolic of all the spiritual wealth coming into Zion. Here's an idea that it might be a little more physical than that. The nations among whom the Jews have been scattered might be said to help the Jews in returning to Zion. This was the case of the return from Babylon, as Ezra reports in chapter 1, verse 4. Let every survivor, wherever he lives, be assisted by the men of that region with silver, gold, goods, and livestock, along with a freewill offering for the house of God in Jerusalem. That's once more. There's enough of references to Old Testament events to make me think that Isaiah was prophesying of the return from Babylon as a type of the Gentiles and converted Jews flocking into the New Testament church. At any rate, God, the Holy One of Israel, has endowed the new Zion with splendor, has endowed Zion with splendor, which I take to be the new Zion, the church, is endowed with splendor. It is not a mere gap or parenthesis. We go now to Isaiah 60, verse 10. Yahweh continues, speaking through Isaiah, "Foreigners will rebuild your walls, and their kings will serve you. Though in anger I struck you, in favor I will show you compassion." In verse 10 of Isaiah 60, Yahweh says that foreigners will rebuild your walls, you're referring to Zion, and their kings will serve you. Though in anger I struck you, in favor I will show you compassion. Now the question is, were these foreigners who rebuilt the old Zion's walls upon the return of the captives from Babylon in 586 BC, or is this referring to Gentiles who will come into the kingdom? Now, most of my commentators says it refers to Gentiles coming into the kingdom. However, I did find one commentator who said that it had a local reference to Old Testament Zion. Benson said that this word foreigners refers to Gentile proselytes helping the returning Jews rebuild the wall. Here's the further quote from Benson. "As Gentile proselytes to the Jewish religion assisted the Jews in repairing the walls of Jerusalem upon their return from captivity, so Gentile converts to Christianity assisted the apostles, evangelists, and other ministers of Christ." So Benson basically says that rebuilding the walls of the old Zion is a type of building up the church of Jesus Christ, the new Zion. At the end of verse 10, Yahweh says, "In anger I struck you." That's probably referring to the old Zion, either in 586 BC by the Babylonians or 70 AD by the Romans. We go now to verses 11 and 12 in Isaiah 60. Yahweh continues speaking to Zion, and Yahweh says, "Your gates will always stand open. They will never be shut, day or night, so that men may bring you the wealth of the nations, their kings led in triumphal procession. For the nation or kingdom that will not serve you will perish. It will be utterly ruined." Now that language doesn't really describe the restored Jerusalem in 586 BC. It just doesn't. The kingdom of Israel was very small. They had some brief independence under the Maccabeans, and then they got taken over by the Romans. The Maccabeans, of course, tried to free them from the Seleucids, that Greek successor kingdom to Alexander the Great. So Israel was always subject since its restoration, except for a brief time under the Maccabeans. It's basically been sort of a pitiful little place. But that's not the way Isaiah describes Zion here. The gates open day and night. Now, what's the meaning of that symbolism? Two options. Option number one, the New Jerusalem will exist in security and peace. The New Jerusalem will not be afraid of enemy conquest. Now, Barnes and Ellicott hold to this view. After all, Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and the gates of a city must be closed when the city is besieged in war. So this is referring to a time when we have peace in the Church of Christ. That's option number one. Option number two as to why the gates will always stand open is because that the influx of Gentile converts into the church will be so great that the gates can never be closed. Not enough time to close them. This is Barnes and Ellicott's view also. The commentators split, usually saying both options are true, i.e., the New Jerusalem will exist in security and peace. It will not need to shut its gate or its gates against enemies. And also, there are going to be so many people flocking into the New Jerusalem, the Gentile converts, they won't have time to close their gates. Now, these gates will never be shut day or night. Note that this verse is quoted in Revelation. Revelation 21:25, John the Apostle says, "And in the daytime," talking about the New Jerusalem, "for in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed." And of course, the symbolism is very clear. People are going to be flocking into the church from all directions, north, east, south, and west, and the kingdom of God will grow mightily and become larger and larger. And that's why I think that the book of Revelation refers to the New Covenant era, the church age, extending, of course, at the end of the church age into the final state. Got no problem with that at the end of the book, but most of the books talk about people coming into the New Covenant. At least it is here in Isaiah. Sure sounds like it. And I think John is saying the same thing in the book of Revelation. There is a slight difference in the quotations here. In Revelation 21:25, there's no night, no darkness, so no need to shut the gates against enemies. But in Isaiah, there is night. The gate will never be shut day or night. Why is the difference? John Gill noticed the difference, and he says that the difference is because in the book of Revelation, the New Jerusalem is referring to Christ ruling personally, i.e. in some kind of future millennium. But Isaiah is talking about Christ ruling spiritually in the church, and we still have night in the church. Well, that's a nice speculation, especially if you're pre-mill. I guess Gill might be pre-mill. I'm not really sure, but I'm not pre-mill, so I don't like that suggestion. In fact, I think that this difference is really a matter of inconsequence. This is an inconsequential matter of detail. The main point is that the Gentiles will be flooding into the kingdom. John adds the point that there will be no light there because Christ will be the light. That's obviously symbolic. People are going to need light. I'll tell you, people will take this literally. Oh, Jesus is going to be shining like a big light bulb right there in the middle of that square city floating in the sky, completely ignoring the spiritual symbolism that is quite obvious in the book of Revelation. Now in verse 11, we see that the men of the world may bring into the new Zion the wealth of nations, as the NIV has it. The KJV has the forces of nations. You'll see that a lot. That would be military forces, I guess. I don't know what that would mean. Wealth of the nations makes more sense to me as a symbol of the prosperity of the church. The kings led in triumphal procession. I think that's a symbol of leaders of nations becoming converted to Christ. Verse 12, for the nation or kingdom that will not serve you will perish. It will be utterly ruined. Sounds like the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. It will be utterly ruined. That very well could happen to us. We go now to Isaiah 60, verses 13 through 16. Yahweh continues, the glory of Lebanon will come to you, the pine, the fir, and the cypress together, to adorn the place of my sanctuary, and I will glorify the place of my feet. The sons of your oppressors will come bowing before you. All who despise you will bow down to you at your feet and will call you the city of the Lord, Zion of the Holy One of Israel. And that's how we know that Zion is being addressed in this whole chapter 60. And also we see once again that Zion is a symbol. Well, it's a reasonable presumption to assume that Zion is a symbol of the New Covenant people of God. Verse 15, although you have been forsaken and hated with no one traveling through, I will make you the everlasting pride and the joy of all generations. You will drink the milk of nations and be nursed at royal breast. Then you will know that I, the Lord, am your Savior, your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. Now in verse 13, Yahweh says the glory of Lebanon will come into Zion. Well, what's the glory of Lebanon? They were famous for their trees, their cedar trees or their cypress trees. The NIV has cypress. I got curious to know whether there is actually any difference between a cypress and a cedar tree. Actually, there's not. They're closely related. I mean, there's slight differences in species and so forth, but they're closely related, as I discovered on homeguides.sfgate.com. We know that the great trees of Lebanon were used to build God's Old Testament sanctuary during the times of Solomon. And of course, that makes a perfect symbol expressing the building of God's New Testament sanctuary. The Old Testament cedars of Lebanon adorned the place of my sanctuary. A sanctuary is a place where God lives. The New Testament is a sanctuary. The New Testament is a temple of the living God. And God says in verse 13 at the end, and I will glorify the place of my feet. Now, there's a couple of options as to what Yahweh is referring to here. He could be referring to the ark, which was in the Holy of Holies in the temple under the mercy seat. The mercy seat was the top of the ark. At the ends of the mercy seat were the two cherubim. Well, I found maybe one or two commentators, I didn't write them down, unfortunately, who said that the place of my feet in verse 13 that Yahweh is talking about the ark itself. The idea being that the Shekinah glory lived above the ark in the Holy of Holies, and God being represented physically, symbolically, the bottom part of that Shekinah glory would rest on the mercy seat. Now, the commentators who use that interpretation refer to 1 Chronicles 28:2, as well as two other verses, which I'll read in a minute. 1 Chronicles 28:2, "Then David the king stood up upon his feet and said, Hear me, my brethren and my people. As for me, it was in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of Jehovah and for the footstool of our God." If you assume that the ark and the footstool are in opposition to one another, well then, the ark is the footstool. Psalm 99:5, "Exalt ye Jehovah our God and worship at his footstool." Well, that doesn't really say that the ark is the footstool, but it does say that there is a footstool somewhere. Psalms 132, verse 7, "Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool." Okay, well, that's one idea, that the ark is the footstool of God, but most of the commentators say the place of my feet is just a general reference to the Jewish temple. His feet were resting in the temple. Here are the commentators that say that: Pulpit, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Barnes, Ellicott, Colin Delitch, and Poole. So we'll go with the majority there. It doesn't really matter. So God's going to glorify where he puts his feet. He's going to glorify his temple made with these beautiful cedars of Lebanon. And of course, in the new covenant, made with living stones, believers. Verse 14, Yahweh says, "The sons of your oppressors will come bowing before you, the sons of the oppressors of Zion." Who are the oppressors of Zion? Well, that would be the Jewish fathers, those lousy kings, if you will, who screwed up Zion. But their sons would be Jews in the new covenant, maybe spiritual Jews, Gentiles, or maybe converted Jews. The sons of the old Zion are the new Zion, and they're going to come, and they're going to straighten things out. These sons will come bowing to Zion. In other words, acknowledging the suzerainty of the church, the new Zion. "All who despise you," all who despise Zion, that would include the Babylonians, "will bow down at your feet and will call you the city of the Lord." That would be all the Gentile nations who have despised Israel all throughout their history. In the New Testament era, when they start getting saved, they're going to bow down to the same nation that they despised. "They will bow down at your feet and will call you the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. Although you have been forsaken and hated," in verse 15, "with no one traveling through," that's because it got burnt to the ground, 586 B.C., "I will make you the everlasting pride and the joy of all generations." That could refer to the physical rebuilding of Jerusalem under Ezra and Nehemiah, but that was such a small temple and a small kingdom and a weak kingdom. The everlasting pride and joy of all generations must refer to the new Zion, the church. Verse 16, "You will drink the milk of nations and be nursed at royal breast." That certainly doesn't sound like the Old Testament restored nation of Israel. You will drink the milk of nations. You'll be nourished by the nations, because you will be all through the nations everywhere, in China, in India, in Africa. You will be nursed at royal breast. Even kings of the earth will have to acknowledge the presence of the church, and not only to acknowledge the presence of the church, but to feed the church, to sustain it. "Then you will know that I, the Lord, am your Savior, your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob." We go now to Isaiah 60, verses 17 through 18. Yahweh continues, "Instead of bronze, I will bring you gold and silver in place of iron. Instead of wood, I will bring you bronze and iron in place of stones. I will make peace your governor and righteousness your ruler. No longer will violence be heard in your land, nor ruin or destruction within your borders, but you will call your walls salvation and your gates praise." Now we see something inferior being replaced by something superior because of these superior materials which were substituted for inferior ones. Gold for bronze, iron for silver, gold for bronze, silver for iron, bronze for wood, iron for stones. Something's better. The simplest way to take that is the new covenant is better than the old covenant. The new Zion is better than the old Zion. John Gill suggests that, but he also says this could refer to the millennial reign at the end of time, the personal reign of Christ at the end of time, replacing the spiritual reign of Christ in the church. That's what's better. Physical reign of Christ is better than the spiritual reign of Christ in the millennium. I don't think Gill is right, but then again, I'm not pre-mill, so that might color my thinking here. The whole idea is this peace here. This is a great covenant. It's better than the old covenant. I think that fits the church nicely, not just a hypothesized millennial kingdom post-second advent. Now, the KJV has something interesting in verse 18. Actually, it's the end of verse 17. I will make peace your governor and righteousness your ruler, says the NIV. The KJV has, instead of ruler, thine exactor's righteousness. I will make thine exactor's righteousness. An exactor was a tax collector. So the KJV has it that God will make tax collectors righteous. Oh, and is there any symbol of oppression more apt than a tax collector? Please forgive me if there are any IRS agents listening to this. Probably not. But even tax collectors will be righteous in the new Zion. But you will call your walls salvation. The new Zion's walls will be called salvation. That sounds like the church, and your gates praise. Well, the church praises. So see, could fit to the So this prophecy could fit the church very easily, as well as a speculated future millennium. We go now to Isaiah 16, verses 19 through 20. Yahweh continues his very optimistic encouragement to the people of Zion. He says, the sun will no more be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun will never set again, and your moon will wane no more. The Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of sorrow will end. Now that verse should sound familiar because it was quoted by John the Apostle in the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 23. And the city, referring to the New Jerusalem, the New Zion, and the city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. That makes me think that Isaiah and John are thinking of the same thing, namely the church, the new covenant people of God. Now, of course, this is metaphorical. It doesn't mean that people don't need light to see in order to see what's in the refrigerator or whatever. No, it's talking about the fact that we have no light. It's talking about the fact that we don't need any light because we have the spiritual light of the gospel, the glory of God shining on us. It's a metaphor. It's not meant to be taken literally. Here's some other scriptural references about God as light. Isaiah 30, verse 26. The moonlight will be as bright as the sunlight, and the sunlight will be seven times brighter, like the light of 7 days. On the day that the Lord bandages his people's injuries and heals the wounds he inflicted. Notice God inflicted wounds because he was punishing the Israelites, but he's going to heal those wounds. Notice the number 7. That's the Hebrew number of completion, maturity, perfection. The sunlight will be 7 times brighter. That means as bright as it needs to be, God's light will be bright. And the moonlight will be bright too, because it's as bright as the sunlight is now. Great poetry there. Revelation 22, verse 5. Night will no longer exist, says John the Apostle, and people will not need lamplight or sunlight, because the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever. And again, that's not talking about photons. It's talking about they don't need anything because Jesus Christ is lighting up their light. They don't need anything spiritually. Don't need anything physically, actually. Nothing. We go now to Isaiah 60, verses 21 through 22, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues, then will all your people, your again refers to Zion, then will all your people, Jerusalem, Zion, be righteous, and they will possess the land forever. They are the shoot I have planted, the work of my hands, for the display of my splendor. The least of you will become 1,000, the smallest, a mighty nation. I am the Lord, and it's time I will do this swiftly. In it's refers to the mighty nation that God's going to create. Now, of course, you could take this all literally and make it refer to the Old Testament people of God, Israel. But, of course, we are going to take it as being fulfilled in the antitype of the old Israel, as fulfilled in the new covenant people of God, the Church of Jesus Christ, the glorious church. Verse 21, then will all your people be righteous. That sounds like Christians being justified by faith through grace. Justified by grace through faith. They will possess the land forever. Now that, of course, sounds like Israel. Most of the translations say land here. The word is eretz. To me, it ought to be earth. John Gill says it's earth. The two literal translations I looked at, the Young's literal and J.P. Green, say that eretz should be translated earth there, and they will possess the earth forever. That sounds like the church. If it's land, it sounds like Israel. Well, if you take it as land, that means that Israel is a type of the church, which will possess the whole earth. Israel possesses the land first and then the earth. They are the shoot I have planted. That would mean the nation of Israel, the small beginnings, the shoot that's planted in the ground of planet earth, the work of my hands for the display of my splendor. The splendor is displayed when the shoot grows into the tree that covers the whole earth. The least of you will become a thousand, the smallest a mighty nation. That refers to the expansion of the church over the world. I am the Lord, I am Yahweh. In its time, the time of this nation, I will do this swiftly. Now what that means is, in its time, in the time of its establishment, when God will do all this, he will do it swiftly at the proper time when it comes about. Now, of course, that wasn't swiftly compared to the time of Isaiah. Isaiah is in the 8th century B.C. We're already in the 21st century A.D. We've already gone 2,800 plus years or so, or let's just say 2,800 years. But the idea is when the time comes, God will establish it very quickly. Here's what Albert Barnes says. When the world shall be molded into a proper state to welcome it, when the nations are prepared to receive it and profit by it, then the universal propagation shall be hastened, and a nation shall be born in a day. Well, I think he's referring to the church, or the culmination of the church, at the final return of Jesus. Meantime, for the coming of that day, we should pray and labor by the diffusion of truth, by schools, by the spread of the Bible, by preaching, by the translation of the Word of God into every language, by establishing the press in all the strong points of pagan influence, by placing missionaries in all the holes of power in the pagan world, and by training up many to enter into the harvest. The Christian world should prepare for the universal conversion of the world to God. In due time it shall be hastened, and he that shall come, and will not tarry. On that eschatological, optimistic note, Albert Barnes concludes our discussion of Isaiah chapter 60. And we are now prepared to go on our next audio to Isaiah 61, which I will entitle The Year of the Lord's Favor. I hope you stay with me for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.